It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine now the potential for diverting water from the Great Lakes to places out west contending with a years-long drought and what this means for the Great Lakes Compact that's led by the governors of 8 states, including Wisconsin. Under federal law enacted 14 years ago, they protect and manage the Great Lakes Basin for future generations. Join in with questions on Great Lakes water becoming a commodity. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Joel Brummeyer is president of the Chicago-based nonpartisan advocacy group Alliance for the Great Lakes. Joel, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So there is this growing speculation that water from the Great Lakes could be a possible source of fresh water for out west, drought-stricken west. How realistic is this? Is it plausible?
Well, I don't think it's realistic, and here's why. One, as you mentioned in the intro, we have this policy called the Great Lakes Compact, which bans most diversions of water from the Great Lakes. So on the legal side, we can dig more into that. Then there's the political side of things. Historically, Great Lakes water supply has been what we would call a political third rail. It's just one of those things you don't mess with because the states guard their water rights so zealously. And so you'd have to have sort of a legal upset, a political upset. And then the third thing is the economics of it all, what it would take to actually transport water over this great distance and great elevation change, extremely expensive. And so it's hard for me to see a future where the biggest risk to the Great Lakes water supply is are exports out west.
Well, regardless of the legality, the political dynamics and the economics of this, do you know what groups or state governments are trying to push this ahead and gain traction?
I think it's really important when we hear about these questions about, out west, hey, we're running out of water. But, as former presidential candidate Bill Richardson said, the Wisconsin is awash in water, right? And got into a lot of trouble for that statement. When we hear those, it's really important to look into what's going on out west, right? So you've got the impacts of drought exacerbated by climate change. You've also got a major user, agriculture, which is the biggest user of the Western water supply. And so I think when I hear this question about moving water across the country, I think about, man, what's it going to take to actually, for those states to actually use their water supplies more efficiently? And it also, I think, for Midwesterners and Great Lakers should raise questions about what if businesses and agriculture starts to come here and look for growth based on that access to easy fresh water supplies, right? Those are the kinds of things that come to my mind when I hear these comments about potentially moving Great Lakes water out west.
And we hear that sentiment echoed elsewhere, that the drought in the West is not the Midwest's problem to fix. This is a region that's known about this problem for decades, hasn't scaled back its water usage. You mentioned large-scale farming, big cities. How do you feel about that attitude?
I think that it's possible for regions, states, watersheds, regions to manage their water sustainably, right? And it's been demonstrated in parts of the American West. It's been demonstrated here in the Midwest that if you think like a watershed, you think like the place you're in, and you really pay attention to where water falls, using it efficiently. And even in ag, I'll acknowledge that in Western agriculture, the water consumption relative to production of crops has gone down over the years because farmers are becoming more efficient about irrigation. I do think we're coming to this point where you have to say, is it sustainable to grow X crop in this place? Or is that going to have to change? You have to grow something differently or move that where that crop is grown, because it's just not sustainable to grow, whatever it is. People talk about almonds or cattle or whatever it is in a particular place. I think those days are coming, and there is going to be a reckoning around that. It's going to have economic, consequences for states that have been really relying on these dwindling water supplies. I think that, though, it's important that states and regions grapple with those based on the water supplies that are in the place that they're in, just like the Great Lakes states are grappling with how to manage this incredible, globally significant water resource that we have in our backyards.
Joel Brumeyer, president of the Chicago-based nonpartisan advocacy group Alliance for the Great Lakes, as we look at potential threats to divert water from the Great Lakes and what protections are in place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us from Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm concerned that if we start burning up our own water resources here and shipping that off, A, who's making the profit off of shipping the water out of here? I don't think it'll be the Great Lakes residents that'll profiteering off of that. And then oncoming droughts, what's that going to do to our own water levels here, you know, around the states? They chose to live down there. They chose to waste the resources.
Oh, Tim, you broke up there, but you also raised, you know, water as a commodity, the commodification of water. Joel, go ahead and respond.
Yeah. Tim raised a really, I think, an important point about the cost of water and where the money goes. So this is something that the state of Michigan has been grappling with, other states have been grappling with in the form of things like food production and especially bottled water production. So we have, you know, as Tim noted, we have this incredible resource here. One of the reasons some people choose to live here is because of this you know, access to water, which is great. The Great Lakes states haven't necessarily been great about realizing the full value of water. One of the big challenges in Michigan, and it was with water bottling, has been this argument about why is it so cheap for companies to bottle water and then sell it, right? The permits to access that water are very inexpensive, and you know the state doesn't, and the people of the state don't realize a lot of economic benefit from it. So there's a big argument about whether that kind of commodification is appropriate, and if it is, then can the state's residents actually get more of a benefit because and raise the cost of that of those water withdrawal permits? So they're actually paying the true cost and getting the true value of this, again, this incredible resource when companies are using it to manufacture products.
Let's dig further on withdrawals from the Great Lakes. We saw in 2016, Waukesha here was given approval to divert millions of gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan for drinking water. Why does Waukesha need this water?
Yeah, again, back to the call, this is good for the caller's point as well about water levels. So Waukesha is the first and only community in the Great Lakes region that has been permitted to divert water outside of the Great Lakes watershed. So a watershed is this place where all the rain falls and it drains into the Great Lakes. Waukesha's outside of that line. It got a permit to divert water and use it. And the important part of that is that it has to actually return the water to the Great Lakes after it's used. So there's no net loss of water, which is a really important part of the compact. Waukesha applied for that permit because it was drawing down its groundwater supply. And in Waukesha was and is a growing suburb of Milwaukee. It needed more water, and it was actually having less access to its groundwater because it was getting contaminated by radium and other chemicals. So as groundwater gets drawn down, it naturally has chemicals, some of which are toxic, get more and more concentrated in that groundwater. So Waukesha went looking for a new water supply. It was under an EPA order to do so. And it settled on applying for Lake Michigan water, which is a very arduous, expensive, and long-term process. And there was a lot of oversight into that application. So that's why Waukesha was searching for a new water supply.
Can you explain the returning of water here in this plan and the returning of wastewater to the Root River?
Right. So water is, and this is why, you know, we think about water not just from what comes out of your tap, not just from what comes out of, you know, what goes into the sewer. It's the whole system, the whole cycle. Waukesha buys water and gets it to its residents, and then the residents use it, and then it has to treat that sewage and return it to Lake Michigan. And so that water gets returned through Racine, through the Root River, after it's been treated as sewage coming out of the municipality of Waukesha. And so this is the same cycle that every community has to run its water through. We all do this every day here in the Great Lakes. You drink the water, you use it, and then it goes back into the sewer system. It gets treated and goes back out into the natural environment. the thing with Waukesha is because it's a very long distance, they pay more to move it that far. So to move their sewage and their treated sewage back out to Lake Michigan costs Waukesha more, for example, than it does Milwaukee because of the distance in part. And so Waukesha has to pay higher rates for this access to Lake Michigan water, which it's chosen to do as a trade-off for getting that diversion and getting that, you know, effectively a guarantee of this really incredible, you know, clean water supply.
Joel Bremeyer leads the nonprofit group Alliance for the Great Lakes, working to protect this natural resource. Join in on what you think about proposals to divert Great Lakes Basin water, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Great Lakes hold an estimated 6 quadrillion gallons of water. We discuss the pressure for water diversion as the West struggles with a years-long drought and how the Great Lakes Compact may respond. Call in about the commodification of water, how to ensure sustainability, purity. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Joel Bremeyer, who is president of Alliance for the Great Lakes. Joel, we heard from Jim in Cedarburg, and Jim wants to know if water that is being returned to Lake Michigan after being borrowed from cities like Waukesha, will it be tested for toxins like radon or PFAS before it goes back into Lake Michigan?
So water that's treated in a sewage treatment plant and then gets discharged back into Lake Michigan has to meet water quality standards of the state and federal government. So, you know, that in Wisconsin, it's Wisconsin DNR. I don't know. I know that this is in discussion right now if there is a discharge standard for PFAS, but that's being discussed right now. It's an active area of negotiation within US EPA for drinking water standards, not for sewage discharge. But that water does have to meet all of the applicable state of Wisconsin water quality standards, just like any other city would. And this is a really important point of the compact, is part of the deal when a community gets approved for a diversion like Waukesha has, is that it has to cause no individual or cumulative what are called adverse impacts to the water quality of the Great Lakes Basin, the Great Lakes watershed. So there's this extra protection in there that makes it, that gives the states an opportunity to go back and say, if a community like Waukesha is causing an environmental problem, to go back and demand accountability from Waukesha and the state of Wisconsin. So there's that extra layer of water quality protection built into the compact, which is another good thing about that policy.
I want to look further into the Great Lakes Compact and framing it here with the approval some years ago now of Foxconn being able to divert 7 million gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan. Environmental groups claiming back in 2018 this had violated the Great Lakes Compact. Has that compact been weakened by that decision?
I don't think that it has. This, and I think this is a really important example when we talk about, when we think about this question of Western states looking for water to support businesses versus businesses, you know, coming to the Great Lakes and accessing our water supplies. Really tricky question. Foxconn was allowed to access water from Racine's public water supply system, which had enough capacity. To allow at the time the facility that people thought was going to get built, to allow Foxconn to access that water for manufacturing. And there was a big debate on whether that use was qualified under the language of the compact. You know, some groups, as you noted, some folks felt that it didn't, others felt that it did. And I think that, you know, I don't see the Foxconn permit for water use as being a weakening of the compact. You know, like a lot of laws, the compact was written in a way that allows some interpretation later on, which, you know, we've been very heavily involved in. And the, you know, the Great Lakes region is full of these big municipal water systems, a lot of which have what are excess capacity, right? So Racine has a lot of water that it's permitted to use that it's not using. And it's, you know, candidly, it, like many other cities, is looking for customers to sell that water to, right? And that's what happened. That's what happened with Foxconn. I think that, you know, that situation is going to be repeated across the Great Lakes region. And it's, so it's important to recognize that we have a lot of water. We have a lot of cities and water users that have excess capacity, you know, to withdraw water and use it and sell it to new users. And I think that pressure on the Great Lakes themselves here at home is probably more immediate of a concern than, you know, potential exports to other parts of the country or other parts of the world. You know, we have a lot of cities looking to sell water here and in a way that's legal. And that's going to increase, I think, over time, the amount of water that's actually being used from the Great Lakes. You know, qualifying that again, all that water ultimately does have to be returned to the Great Lakes after it's used.
So what I'm hearing is that you do expect more municipalities around the lakes to seek permission to divert water for various reasons.
Oh yeah, certainly. I think more municipalities seeking ways to sell more water, both within the watershed and in diversions that would need to be approved by the states, right? So the Southeast Wisconsin, Northwest Indiana are two areas, and leaving Illinois out because Illinois has a whole special exception to all this because of the diversion through the Chicago River. But that area of Southeast Wisconsin and Northwest Indiana is very, the watershed boundary that limits where water can go is very close to Lake Michigan. And there's a lot of growth in those areas. So there's going to be more and more pressure for communities like Waukesha to look for new water supplies. I think that's definitely coming. You're going to see the same thing in the coming decades in Northern Ohio, where you have a similar kind of geography. So I think that pressure is real and it's going to be very prominent in the rest of the 21st century.
Talking about the Great Lakes Compact, Joel Bremeyer with us, president of Alliance for the Great Lakes. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you find that the governors of the eight states in the compact are on the same page about these challenges that they are being confronted with?
Well, the governors historically are on the same page in blocking diversions. And even when there's a diversion that is applied for legally, like Waukesha, there's some governors were not initially on board with approving that diversion, and Waukesha's water use actually got cut way, their proposed water use got cut way back during that process. But generally the governors are on the same page about saying no to diversions, certainly anything outside of what's contemplated in the compact. So there's a unified front there. I think when it comes to water use within the Great Lakes region, within the Great Lakes states, it's a different story. Governors have very different interpretations of water use policy. One of the things about the compact that gets talked about a lot less is that it doesn't just ban diversions, but it requires the states to have kind of the same legal floor of permits for water uses within the state, within the Great Lakes Basin. But the way that, say, Ohio interprets that versus Michigan versus Wisconsin is pretty different. And so it's good that that legal floor is there. But I think a lot of the, when we talk about strengthening the compact,
yes,
a lot of the action is really at the state level. It's really going into those state water withdrawal permit programs that are pretty new, and in some cases haven't been tested as much as you know we would like, and really pushing for additional protections, you know, in some cases additional restrictions where it's appropriate on water use, and making sure that as one of the callers said earlier, that the people of the state are when water is being used, that it's being, you know, especially by some of these large commercial users, that it's being paid for, and that the people of the state are benefiting from those uses. All that action, right, is at the state level. It lies with the governors and the state legislatures. I think that's really important for making sure the Great Lakes are protected, you know, for the next 100 years.
And we only have a few moments left here, but how could the compact be improved? Michigan, I understand, has made a lot of strides.
Yeah, well, Michigan, I like the Michigan example because it has this, it actually has a science-based tool that's used to assess whether groundwater and surface water is connected. And so when this water gets withdrawn, it has impacts on the surface. Michigan looks at that connection and uses it to determine whether a new water use can be permitted. That's a great kind of ecologically based test.
Science-based approach.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So those kinds of tools are out there. And I think the more we push to make those kinds of improvements and other kinds of improvements like we've talked about, that's what's going to be make sure that the Great Lakes water supply is here for today and for generations to come.
Joel, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Joel Brummeyer is president of the Chicago-based Alliance for the Great Lakes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Opioid overdose deaths are increasing across Wisconsin, and the Menominee Indian Tribe has the highest rate of deaths. But tribal leaders are working on new approaches to address the issue. Evan Casey reports on what the tribe and its 8,500 members are doing to curb the increase.
On the day her first son was born, Lighty Dodge's dad died of a drug overdose. Just 2 years later, her mother died from liver failure. Following a battle with alcoholism, Dodge was just 21 years old. She started taking prescription drugs to help deal with the grief. That quickly turned to illegal drugs.
I got really bad on heroin, and then heroin wasn't enough, so then I got really bad on fentanyl, and I got introduced to the wrong people.
Dodge is Native American and a direct descendant of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. She battled addiction for years while living on the tribe's Northeast Wisconsin reservation. She was in and out of drug court and treatment centers. But in 2021, she got clean. Today, she's 29 years old and 20 months sober. She says she wants to be there for her children.
Had it not been for them and my family and the team that I had, I might not have made it, right? Like, this is my first time actually trying to get sober, right? Going to treatment, doing the things that I needed to do, and really setting, like, the foundation for my recovery to build.
Unfortunately, Dodge's story of addiction is not unique to her. National stats show Native Americans experience higher overdose death rates than other racial and ethnic groups. Overdoses among all races soared during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they haven't declined yet. Many of the deaths involve fentanyl, a drug 80 to 100 times stronger than morphine. That's something Wisconsin's Menominee Indian Tribe is trying to fight. Menominee County has the highest overdose death rate in the entire state. Last year, the tribe saw a record 16 overdose deaths. On a sunny Monday in January, a group of tribal officials gathered in the reservation's community center for a meeting of its new drug intervention team.
Welcome, everybody. We're gonna go ahead and get going with our drug intervention team meeting here.
Police Chief Keith Turtelot is on the team. He says the issue is so bad, his officers are getting burned out from all the calls they're going to.
It's a common situation that we go from one overdose to the next.
The chief says police regularly give out the overdose reversal medication, Narcan.
But we need to make sure that we can get to them and get them into treatment and get them help, and that's what this whole organization is about.
The team is working to coordinate efforts with law enforcement, as well as to increase prevention and treatment efforts on the reservation. They're also working to get more recovery coaches. They'll be available through a 24/7 hotline. Addie Caldwell is a member of the team and the director of the Manisakio Wellness Center. She envisions the coaches as the initial contact for someone who is seeking to get clean.
They're our first stop. They're the first person that's going to meet with someone to figure out where that person is at, what that person needs, and then kind of tailor what they are doing to fit what that person needs.
In a phone conversation, Caldwell said the issue often starts at home.
You know, we have multiple generations sometimes in one household, and if one person is struggling with addiction, that potentially is being seen by, you know, younger kids.
Today, Lighty Dodge is living in Shawano and working as a recovery coach for others who also want to get clean. She has 5 boys and a 6-month-old daughter. She says she's encouraged by the work the tribe is doing. She's now attending meetings of the intervention team.
I want to show people, right? It is possible. It's possible to do it. Like, to get through probation, get through recovery, to do these things and get turn your life around and really do it, right? And not just say you're doing it.
Tribal leaders are making progress on many of the new initiatives they started to discuss last year. Just 2 weeks ago, many of the new recovery coaches met for the first time. They're hoping to make an immediate impact. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now, church leaders grapple with white Christian nationalism in American politics and how to minister amid deep divisions. The term referring to people who believe our country was founded by Christians who modeled laws after Protestant ideals with a mission to spread those ideals above all. Call in with questions about white Christian nationalism, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Reverend Leah Shade is an associate professor of preaching and worship at Lexington Theological Seminary in Kentucky. Leads workshops for clergy on how to counter Christian nationalism during Lent. Reverend Shade, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, for this invitation. I'm really honored to be with you today.
Well, let's reflect a bit, a moment. What are you thinking about on the day after Ash Wednesday?
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking about is how to equip pastors and preachers to address Christian nationalism during Lent. And I developed a series of sermon helps to give them ideas for looking at some of the biblical texts and seeing how we can help counter things like anti-Semitism, disability discrimination, racism, violence, misogyny, and all of those things that are part of the white Christian nationalist platform.
One of your sermon helps, and you mentioned it there, was a workshop encountering the misogyny and toxic masculinity of Christian nationalism. Can you talk a bit with us on how you approach this issue?
Yes, one of the things that is a basis for Christian nationalism is a hierarchical view of humanity, where white Christian males are on top of the pyramid, and white Christian females are just below them. And then it goes in descending order to people of color and all the way down to creation at the lowest level. So anybody who is deemed to be less than or other than straight white Christian individuals is seen as lesser than and needs to be either highly regulated, as we're seeing in all of the laws that are being passed and all of the policies that are being put forward to promote this agenda, or to do violence to these individuals and erase their historical memory and just truly make America into this distorted ideal of what they think Christianity is, which is actually the opposite, the very opposite of what Jesus taught.
How do you connect that then to a sermon and what a pastor or a minister would say with those thoughts and ideals being held by congregants?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the texts that I look at is the story in John, the Gospel of John, about Jesus meeting the Samaritan woman at the well. And in that society, women were deemed to be lower than men. They were seen as property. And so when Jesus encounters her, he treats her with respect. He talks to her about living water, you know, what can sustain people beyond the ephemeral things that we think are going to give our lives meaning. Talks to her about, the gift of eternal life. And has a very frank discussion with her about the fact that she has five husbands. And in that society, the reason she would have five husbands is not because she's some kind of like Hollywood starlet who's a serial divorcer, but but in fact, in that society, if a husband decided to discard a wife, she was damaged goods, and she would, be passed around, her spouse died, and she had to be married to the spouse's brother. So all of these things made her contemptible in her society. So when Jesus talks to her as an equal and entrusts her with the message of good news that he's trying to proclaim in that time, she goes to her community and they see her with new eyes, and she's actually restored to her community. She's given respect. So this is very much the opposite of the way males are treated or females are treated by, say, individuals like the former president who wanted to grab females by their genitals and to do anything with them that he felt he wanted to do because he had that power and he had that authority to do that. So there's a stark contrast from what we see that Jesus does compared to the values that we see within white Christian nationalism.
I want to touch here on, your book, as you look at the impact of former President Donald Trump preaching in the purple zone. You know, he's running for president in 2024. I wonder, how will you approach your work and preaching in the wake of that announcement compared to the last time he ran?
Yes, that's an important point, because one of the things that we in the group that I also co-founded called the Clergy Emergency League, which is a network of pastors who are really trying to do the counter Christian nationalism. We realized early on that even after the former president had been voted out of office, that he was not going away. And not only is he running again, but his minions are promoting his message of white Christian nationalism at the local, state, and national level. And so it's very important for pastors to talk with their congregants, educate, use resources, use book studies, and encourage their congregants to take action to protect those most vulnerable in our society. So my book, Preaching in the Purple Zone, Ministry in the Red-Blue Divide, offers a method to do that I call the sermon dialogue sermon process, where a pastor can preach a sermon that invites people into what's called deliberative dialogue in order to use their critical thinking skills and to find the values that are important to them on contemporary topics that are affecting the lives of their congregants and the community. And then a follow-up sermon to say, here are the values, here's the common ground that we saw as a group, even in the midst of our differences, and here's where God might be calling us to move forward as a congregation.
What if they don't want to talk? What if dialogue isn't something that they want to be a part of?
Well, you're right. Not everyone is open to dialogue, because dialogue for some feels like a threat to their ideology. So for the people who are not going to participate, that they're going to self-select out. There's not much you can do about that other than to keep the invitation open, keep the pastoral relationships as much intact as possible, continue to treat them with love and respect that is modeled for us by Christian and Jewish teachings. And for the people who do want to engage these conversations, and I will tell you from the surveys that I've done of parishioners and pastors over the last 6 years, people actually do want to, the majority of people do want to engage these conversations because they're looking for biblical and theological guidance for how to think about these social issues that are affecting their lives and their families and their neighbors.
Author and ordained Lutheran minister Leah Shade with us, helping clergy and congregations take on these social issues with a nonpartisan, Bible-centered approach. She contributed to the Wisconsin Council of Churches' new guide on Jesus and Justice in Public, it's called. Join in on white Christian nationalism, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Reverend Leah Shade on the faculty of Lexington Theological Seminary about the rising influence of white Christian nationalism and how church leaders are responding. She co-founded the Clergy Emergency League. This is a network of thousands of pastors nationwide navigating political issues. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Charlotte now in Milwaukee. Charlotte, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. Hey, I'm a Black woman that goes to an all-Black church, and we do talk about Black power nowadays. How do we tell our white children that it's different than white power?
Charlotte,
wow,
thank
I'm
you.
So
yes,
glad for that question. So one of the things that's really important for white allies to do with our children is to teach them history, to teach them that for centuries, slaves had no power, were not even regarded as fully human. And so when we hear the term Black power, whites are going to feel some anxiety. You know, there's this, you know, this concern that Blacks are going to take over. But if you understand it historically, to realize this is about the balancing and the restoration and the reparations that are due to our siblings of color. And so to recognize their contributions, their achievements, what they have given to this country, what has been stolen from them in terms of their labor and their bodies. So Black power is about restoration and acknowledging them as fully human, having full rights, and being able to be leaders and contributors in this society. And so when we see this legislation that's being passed to take to not teach African-American history or to not teach critical race theory, which most of them don't even understand what that means, we can see this is a movement to silence those voices, to actually disempower and to erase that history. So white allies need to push back at this at all levels.
You surveyed how often religious leaders use the church to preach about social justice or politics. What have you found?
Well, now I just want to clarify. I wouldn't say that they use the church to teach about or preach about these issues. What most pastors want to do is to be able to bring a biblical and theological lens and an ethical and moral one to the issues that are affecting people. So they're not trying to push a political agenda per se. What they're recognizing is that like politics really comes from the Greek word polis, which means citizens. So anything that affects the citizens is going to be something that we can talk about. And we see this modeled all throughout the scriptures. We see that the prophets of Israel talked about contemporary issues of their time. We see that Jesus talked about taxes. He talked about who has access to health care, how we're going to distribute wealth, how we're going to treat people who are considered outsiders, all of those things. So what we're seeing in the surveys that we've done since 2017 is that mainline Protestant pastors are actually being more willing to address these issues because they're seeing how much it affects their folks. Even if they get pushback that, well, you're being too political, a lot of them are willing to take that risk because they know what's at stake. Now, it does depend on whether a pastor is particularly vulnerable. So if you have a pastor of color in a white congregation, if you have a female pastor in a rural congregation, those kinds of constellations of characteristics might make a pastor feel more vulnerable and less willing to engage those topics.
There are still the power dynamics there.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Reverend Leah Shade with us is an associate professor of preaching and worship at Lexington Theological Seminary. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Patrick now in Viroqua. Patrick, hi.
Hey, good morning. Good show. I'll make this quick. There's a radio station, has a strong signal all over Wisconsin called Voice of Christian America. I think it's based in Toma. Anytime you turn it on, they're talking hate. Your fellow American is evil and the enemy, particularly with gays and lesbians. And are you doing anything to try to keep them in their lane? This is terrible.
That's exactly the kind of thing that we're trying to equip pastors and their congregations to speak out against, because this is not Christian. In fact, it's the exact opposite of what Jesus taught. And so one of the things that I really want to highlight and encourage pastors to look at is the Wisconsin Council of Churches resource called Jesus and Justice in Public. It is a guide for conversation about how to identify what's going on with Christian nationalism, what is the rhetoric they're using, why is it so attractive to certain individuals, and what are the ways that we can counter that and stand with vulnerable peoples who are being attacked and violently hurt and even killed by white Christian nationalists. So thank you for raising awareness about that presence on the airwaves.
We hear the word freedom attached to white Christian nationalists at times, and I wonder what that word means in the context of a religious congregation.
Right. So it's interesting the way they're using the word freedom. So they want to be free to do whatever they want to do, to pass whatever laws they want to pass, to bully whoever they want to bully, to do whatever they want to do. But they don't want others to have the same freedoms. So there's a deep hypocrisy in the use of that word, but it has such a strong resonance with American citizens that when somebody hears that word, it has an emotional component. And so when somebody says, oh, we can't regulate guns because that's taking away your freedom to have guns, which is, you know, it's not true. It's actually a lie. We want people to have freedom for life, for thriving, for equality and equity, and just simply the rights of people like our trans siblings and our LGBTQIA siblings and our siblings of color and indigenous communities to exist. That's the freedom that we want, for them to exist and have full rights and citizenship and protection.
Reverend Shade, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the invitation. Thanks for having me here.
Reverend Leah Shade is an associate professor of preaching and worship at Lexington Theological Seminary. She contributed to the Wisconsin Council of Churches' new guide. It's called Jesus and Justice in Public. You can find a link to her blog called Eco Preacher at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.